Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. I'm Don Allen over in Studio A, and in Studio B is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards. Good morning, Mr. Edwards. How are you?
Good morning, Mr. Allen. How are you doing this morning? Yes. Another snowy morning here in our Twin Cities. People are starting to get panicky,
yeah.
But hey, this is Minnesota. We're still in Black History Month. We're coming down to the final days, if you will. A lot of activities, a lot of awards and things being given out to, I guess, what you would call black historians, if you will. But we wanted to continue to carry the tradition of the Don and Ron program, take a look at some of the black history that maybe doesn't get recognized because, you know, it hasn't been signed off on by, you know, the white historians. You know what I'm saying, Don? I hate to say it like that, but that's kind of been the tradition. And then folks just kind of are comfortable with that. But we've got a lot to look at, Don, in the 58 minutes that we have, if you will. Phone lines will be open. We'll not be entertaining a lot of questions unless they have, you know, absolute specificity or raising a question of specific detail. You understand what I'm saying, Don? Because we're going back this morning, my brother, to newspaper articles going back as far as 1912.
Whoa.
Yeah, 1912.
It's going to be a very interesting show this morning. That number to call in. Of course, if it's relevant, 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. And those of you watching the live streaming part of this program on social media, on Facebook, the picture that you see in the background is Mr. Ronald A. Edwards, probably the number one black American civil rights historian in Minnesota, and has more documented and history than most of the people that we usually hear about in the mainstream receiving, you know, these awards every year during Black History Month. It's some, Mr. Edwards, as we talked in our production meeting, I said, you know, I'm a little bit troubled by the fact that the people, I mean, they know you. You've been on MTN, Minneapolis Television Network, for more than 20 years with Black Focus.
Yeah.
27 years, and you've written a few books, The Minneapolis Story, that if anybody wants to learn the inner dealings and minglings of how organizations worked and how they began to crumble in the black community in Minnesota, you should go pick up a copy of Mr. Ronald A. Edwards' Through My Eyes. And
and
it's
also
an important piece.
A Place at the Table, yes, which was a publication about a decade ago, yes. Yes, we believe in putting our chronicle on the table. In fact, that's one of the reasons this morning, the example of Don, we will be going back starting in 1911 with one of the great cover-ups that unfortunately led to a lot of suffering, illness, and pain. It has to do with the Bassett Crick, if you will, and that whole scandal, if you will, what it did to the about 8 years later, the emerging Negro commercial area of 6th Avenue North, later referred to as the Floyd B. Olson Memorial Highway, now also referred to as Highway 55. You know, we drank that the pieces that we've had, of course, in our possession for a number of years, that talks in terms of how the whole issue of toxicity and et cetera came into play and why. In fact, we have some older African-Americans listening right now, I know for a fact, whose family members were, you know, infected by the radon gas, the other kinds of environmental acts that were carrying on. It's just it's a heck of a story. It has no relevance to a person if they, you know, can't read, don't read, or don't research. You know, Don and I talk oftentimes about the importance of research, if you will, and do your own research. Don't let Massa tell you what it is you should be researching. But I've determined over the last 5 years that people really don't care. You know, they just did whatever the man says, that this is what it was. And it was one of the things that led to significant illness and et cetera. But I want to do this morning, Don's induction meeting. I want to really hope that maybe sometime in the next couple of years that the folks that do all these handing out awards will hand out our awards and recognize the two first African-Americans to be allowed to move in to public housing called the Sumner Field Home, beautiful places at that time, in North Minneapolis, if you will. It's now the, what, Legacy Village or whatever. But in 1938, and there is a lovely picture, you know, we will be showing these photographs of these two lovely African-American women, Don, so that the world can recognize. Obviously, both of them are deceased. I'm not sure. I've not been able to find the three little girls who are in the pictures with their mother, Mrs. Brown. Say, Miss Austin, Sonia Austin, 71 years of age. Beautiful picture of her. She's standing in her laundry room, brand new laundry room, electric washer and dryer and et cetera, man, just great, brand new apartments and et cetera that were buried. The other is a picture of Miss Brown with her three lovely daughters sitting on the couch in their brand new apartment in the Sumner Field Homes. And so we just wanted this morning recognize Miss Austin and Miss Brown and Mrs. Brown's three children as the first African Americans. I know it may be puzzling to some of you youngsters, Don, but you know, when the public housing facilities were opened, they were segregated. I know that's kind of stunning to you, Don, and I know our liberal friends, you know, don't like for us to talk like that, but that's, you know, that's what it was. Any specific question on that, Don, on the two lovely ladies?
Well, I'm interested in the Summerfield. You said they were segregated, so they had were the majority of the people there white, Native American?
Native Americans didn't get no public housing at all. That was a damn shame. What happened as the outgrowth courageous actions of a woman by the name of Nellie Stone Johnson, starting in 1934 and 35, which will be documented and shown by us on Tuesday. Nellie Stone Johnson, Bill Cratchit, who was president, name that's fallen from memory, particularly in light of the fight that's going on over at the NAACP right now in Minneapolis. But anyways, Bill Cratchit was president, long time serving president of the NAACP of Minneapolis, and Nellie, the late and beloved Cecil Newman and some others had fought very hard to break the barrier of segregation in public housing, and particularly with this brand new public housing, about 268 units and et cetera. And so when Miss Austin and Miss Brown, Wilma Brown, were brought in January of 1938, if you will. Actually, the new homes were set to open up on December 16th, 1938. By the way, the average rent per room was $4.40 per person. And these are articles in the white paper now, the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Okay, so no one is due. But let me just also give the ages of the three beautiful African-American children. By the way, Ms. Brown was employed. She worked as a storekeeper, if you will. And she's at with her three daughters, and they are Wilma, Judith, and Gwendolyn. They are ages 5, 3, and 11, if you will. I have reason to believe that, unfortunately, they may not all be alive, obviously. I mean, let's see, for real, Miss Austin, so the Austin obviously passed from this life a long time ago. But the picture, again, the Minneapolis Star, not Star Tribune, because the Star and Star Tribune are not birds, if you will. We also have, Don, just for the purposes of discussion and your reflections, we have documents from the Federal Emergency Administration Housing Division, if you will, located at 638 McKnight in Minneapolis, if you will, and documents that you were required to sign and et cetera, and talk in terms of your occupation, the total yearly income of my family is, blah, 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 blah. You know, we've seen that thing, kind of thing before. But anyways, these two lovely African-American women and the three children of Ms. Brown need to at least be recognized that they were the first African-Americans, though it was segregated, that were allowed in the Sumner Field home. By the way, let's just clear up this right quick. Sumner Field, we also have the schematics, if you will, the documents used by the city of Minneapolis to begin demolitions and et cetera. In late 1935, Don, as they began the construction, there was another set of similar housing of all places, and I had many, many, many. I was, in fact, on this, I wasn't even born myself. I had seen a series of homes, if you will, public housing and et cetera, in Syracuse, New York. Don, Syracuse, New York, exactly designed like the Sumner Field home. They were called Central Village, for those that, that like to talk in terms that we don't know what we're talking about in the session. They were the Central Village Project, CBO, if you will, in Syracuse, New York. Exact same design. Now, the person that was in charge of the actual design, the gentleman, Caucasian, Herman E. Olson, for all of those that want to confirm. The chief draftsman was, and I'm going to give the spelling, Don, so that people can run to their computers if they want. The central, the key draftsman, the paramount draftsman, was a W, last name spelled a G-U-M-B-R-I-L-L, okay, Gumbel. And the supervisor of the drafting and other kinds of demolition was F.F. Last name spelled A-H-L-S-T-E-D-T. Now, these are the original documents, Donald, of the preparing for the construction, if you will, after the announcement was made in early 1935 that this public housing would be available. And through the efforts of Nellie Stone Johnson, Cecil Newman, and other great, great, great civil rights leaders that are never recognized by anybody, that the federal government agreed that there would, that the housing would be segregated, but it would be proportional. Same number of Negroes that were allowed into the public housing, same number of whites. The red line actually ran right down the middle of what was then Sumner Field, if you will, a recreation field, baseball diamonds, and et cetera. In fact, one of the people that lived in the segregated facilities on the white side was the young lady who is the, still the head of PICA, Alice Running. Alice Running. Her, you know, she's known now as Alice Dillon, but she was born Alice Running, if you will. Alice will, you know, probably come clean talking terms that, yes, her family was placed on the white side. You know what I'm saying? But we have segregated houses. Yeah. But it was not broken, but it was broken by Nellie Stone Johnson. And, again, what happens is they went out, got Marion McLeod Bethune, the great civil rights activist who was a very close friend, blessed friend, of Eleanor Roosevelt, the wife of the president of these United States. And Eleanor Roosevelt took up the issue, and she wore the Federal Housing Administration out, and these agreements were reached. Now, the Sumner Field housing that everybody talks about was not officially desegregated. Notice the word that I used, Don, desegregated until around 1949. So it took to after the Second World War to finally at least make some segment of housing unsegregated. Yeah. Any questions, Don?
Now, yes, yes. I have two questions. Mm-hmm.
is where was in the Twin Cities, where was the pocket of Black Americans who lived here, who migrated here? I mean, the first community, the first neighborhood. That would be
the first question.
St. Anthony. Yeah.
Community St. Anthony.
Okay.
Not St. Anthony, okay. Maine, or over there at the village of St. Anthony. That was the first enclave. Now, the real first stop had to be, though, Fort Snelling, where the determination had to be made of, you know, was your Negro a free or enslaved individual. But to the pockets that started, Negroes lived in encampments on the grounds of the military post called Fort Snelling. And then as they were allowed to move out into the countryside, if you will, they moved into the village of St. Anthony. Now, the documentary North Star, which showed this past Monday, attempted to talk in terms of the history of that, but I'm not sure that they brought all of the pertinent information, and then, of course, you don't know if anybody asked any questions. Now, after that, after about 5 or 6 years of Negroes being allowed to in the village of St. Anthony, Negroes started moving into a place called Minneapolis. Now, they started living in what is called and referred to as the Seven Corners area, like where the Marriott Courtyard Hotel is.
Okay.
And the University of Minnesota. University of Minnesota is beginning to expand its campus and et cetera. I mean, by this time now, we're talking the 1800s, right? Okay. So what basically happened is that in around 1908, 1909, they started talking about where to really put the Negro community, but the Jewish community got first called. And Jews were being allowed to move into what was called Sixth Avenue North, and that was an area that expanded from Olson Highway on the south to as far up as maybe Broadway. Okay. Now, Negroes could not go on the other side of Fremont and Plymouth, if you will. In fact, police would stop you, etc. And so to the question of anybody that may be texting you a question or etc., it actually wasn't until 1956, 57 that we started being allowed as young Negroes to go on the other side of Fremont. Now, we could go as far north as long as we were going to visit Negroes in Humboldt Heights, which is right there on the city limits and center and the city of Minneapolis. So we had an interesting city back in the day. And some of that was certainly long before I was born. But again, as a historian, you know, one has researched it. Go ahead, Dine. So you had a second question?
Yeah. Okay. And so going back to the Sumter, the segregated housing projects, for lack of a better term, were there racial turmoils reported between, you know, across the red line?
No. Okay. No. These were all poor people. You know, no, there was not conflict. There was discipline, and people always talked about that because the respected leadership of both communities, Black and white, worked hard for that to be successful. The other thing is, man, people were enjoying housing that they'd never seen in their life. I mean, I'm being very, very serious. Running water, warm water, et cetera. I mean, I talked about the laundry rooms, the et cetera, beautiful parts. There was actually a store on site there on the south end of Sumner Field. In fact, the Miss Brown that we talked about worked there as a storekeeper. So to your question, Negroes were basically, let's say, prior to 19, basically lived in the Humboldt Heights area, the Snelling area, which is around 36th and 37th and Snelling in South Minneapolis, next to what was a big fairgrounds, if you will. In fact, it was actually the largest fairground in the state of Minnesota until the state built the fairground in Fulton Heights, if you will. So that was basically where it was at, if you will. There was later a small Negro enclave of fairly professional Negroes, whatever that meant, you know, wearing white shirts and et cetera. that started being allowed to buy homes around 24th, 25th, 27th, and 4th Avenue, slowly moving south across Lake Street. For a number of years, about 20 years, they were stopped basically at 38th and 4th Avenue, with the exception of the small black enclave. That's where St. James, the Anthony Church, comes from, over there, right there on, what, 35th, 36th, and Snelly or whatever. I'm seeing a text message from a person that I know who grew up in that community and then relocated to Humboldt Heights, if you will. In fact, a couple years ago, I had the former city council president and a good friend, Barb Johnson, because she was a part of the community that welcomed and worked with the Negroes coming into the Humboldt Heights area, which actually started as early as 1885, 1890. And that's where, by the way, just for purposes of history, that's where the little black church of Pilgrim Rest was found. The expansion did not start until 1919, when Negroes started being allowed to rent housing and commercial property on what was called 6th Avenue North. Are you following me?
Yes, I am.
Yeah. And so by 1919, Negroes started moving into the what was called the Near North Side, later called the Hot Boogie Woogie area, and et cetera. The expansion south, if you will, really didn't take place until around 1951, 52, 53, all right? In North Minneapolis, it was consolidated strongly in what was called the Glenwood area and specifically the Sumner Field housing. Now, in the Glenwood situation, Negroes could not go south of Glenwood, because that put them up against the Finnish community. We used to call that Little Finland. Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah, I was just
asking
some
questions. Right.
Yes, you did. And I'm going to let our listeners know that our call-in number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. So, Mr. Edwards, I guess in my series of questions here, where was the economic hub? Like, we know in Tulsa they had Black Wall Street, if there was one in Minnesota for the black community.
6th Avenue North.
Okay.
It was a 12-block area, 6 blocks on each side, starting about a block and a half of east of Glendale and 6th Avenue North, down to Emerson, maybe Fremont, in the area where the Sumner library is now. That was the economic hub. In fact, we may show some pictures of what was initially the African-American or Negro business district before they began to tear down, because one of the things that unfortunately happened is that with the building of the Sumner Field homes, that whole economic area on the north side of 6th Avenue North was lost. That area was raised, if you will. But they still had the area on the south side that included things like a movie theater. That was the only Negro-owned and operated movie theater, going even back to the days of the silent pictures, if you will. And there was a business center. There was a place called the Keystone, which was a business center and et cetera, pool hall, barbershops. Second floor was a dance hall, so the Negroes had a place to go, because many could not rent anything for, a dance and et cetera. So we had one of the top jazz clubs and boogie woogie, as they used to call it in the United States, called Howard's Steakhouse. It had a capacity of about 150. It was right there between Bendale and Aldrich. And there were many, many businesses. In fact, at one time, the Negro community, 1930s, even the Depression, had 3 black cab companies. They only had, I mean, they had, you know, wow, three cabs each and et cetera, but that would still, because, oh, that's right, white taxi cabs would not pick you up. And, in fact, it was
wow,
late Frank Olson's beloved Danny Davis Jr. and others that fought that battle in 1965-66 to get Negroes the right. Now, we had cab companies, but we couldn't pick up, quote-unquote, white fares, if you would. You know what I mean? I mean, the brothers found a way to do that. But it, the only way that you could get a cab, let's say that you were in North Minneapolis, you were in Seven Corners area, if you will, or you were out on 37th Avenue, et cetera, and you needed a cab, you would have to call the Negro cab company. There were three at one point.
Oh, wow.
Acme, Black Star, and Black Checker. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so your television show on Minneapolis Television Network, NTN, what channel is that and what time and what day? Because people are asking me. They're sending me messages now.
NPR. I mean, it's NTN. It comes on every Tuesday. It's been coming on for 25 years. But it comes on NTN's networks. That's where you find it, you know, channel 16 and 17.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. I hope that answered your question, listener. You could have called in and asked. So with that said, so the wasn't there something in history about some contaminated land over north?
Yes, let me go back to that because I touched on that at the beginning of the program. In 1910, there began to be a concern within the medical community that there were too many deformed births taking place in that area around Aldrich, Bryant, Colfax, and et cetera. And concern about the contamination, the toxicity, and et cetera. And in 1913, the architects, engineers came up with a grand plan. First of all, they tore down two blocks of housing, which was heavily contaminated, and that's how Sumner Field, Athletic Field, came into existence. Okay. But they still couldn't get around the number of deformities that were taking place. Now, you have to understand, at that particular time, 1911, 1912, 1913, 14, there were no really Negroes living in that area. Negroes did not start coming into that part of North Minneapolis until around, as I said earlier, 1920, 1921. Federal Housing Administration opened up Sumner Field Homes, as I said, in early 1938.
Mm. So what was the...
Oh, let me go back now. There are many documents
okay.
that we will show the press coverage because there were a number of deaths of workers because even under the freeway as we speak there, the big freeway there is a massive pipe that was being put in 1921, 22, and 23. And what happened was the sophistication, level of sophistication, et cetera, was not what it should have been. And about eight or nine workers, both black and white, died from radon gas poisoning because they were, so many of them were working below the ground line, okay? But there are documents, which, of course, we have in our archives, if you will. I'll just give you a couple of dates, Don, again, for folks that run around and saying, those that can gain access, I will read the headline, and then hopefully, you know, people can go, because I'm not certain that I'm going to do it for them. Northsiders move on. Actions at Bassett Creek, March 14th, 1913. This one, relief for Creek victims, the creek being Bassett Creek, March 16, 1913. In other words, the newspapers, the Minneapolis Journal, white newspaper, they actually had a police patrol boat activity down there because the people were fishing in the water and et cetera. They were also having problems. These are the headlines. These are headlines. These are frozen sewers and et cetera causing additional difficulty in the neighborhood. That was March 14, 1913. Nice. March 16, 1913, they began to talk in terms of the city council. Oh, by the way, back in those days, there were 13 wards. There were 26 council members. You used to have, up until 1950, you used to have two council members for each ward. Okay. On March 21st, 1913, the Minneapolis Journal and the Minneapolis Star reported Bassett Creek Bill passes, and $10,000 bond issue for covering stream approved by the House. Okay, that was over in the good old Minnesota legislation. And then the final one, if you will, Bassett Creek covering is delayed until spring, August 21st, 1913. There are many pictures showing the filth of Bassett Creek, which was overflowing, human contamination. You know what I'm saying, Don. Article here in January 24th, almost 20 years later. This is for those that want to check and verify. The Minneapolis Tribune, Sunday, January 24th, 1937. Bassett Creek in early days and when it was a dumpy. And then they talked about how long we used to go and et cetera. So those are documents from way back, Don. And there are many more. In fact, we do have a very dated document of as Creek looked back in 1894. And we have in our archives a picture that was taken of the water backing up. Garbage and stuff feeling. Now, there was one African-American, he's now deceased, God bless him. His name was Robert Samples. Mr. Samples is known by some of the folks of my age group, 80s and et cetera. He, way back in 1973, was interested in cleaning up Bassett Creek because it was starting to fall back into disarray, decay. Again, his name was Bob Samples. In fact, there was an editorial, let me just do this, John, an editorial, Minneapolis Star Tribune, January 5th, 1977, entitled Reclaiming Bassett Creek. That just goes to show you how bad it was. Now, to the question about Sumner Field, again, authenticating. Don't want to waste our time with folks talking about that this didn't happen and et cetera. First city WPA project is launched. This was in preparation for the building of the Sumner Field Homes, dated September 23rd, 1935. Right? That's in the archives. 100 to go to work. At the libraries, if you will, there was some kind of plan, sounds like modern day, dealing with the library there. This was dated September 23rd also, 1935. Then we did have some altercations, but it had nothing to do with race. It's poor people in the midst of the Depression. Squatters forced from home to jail. Okay? And this was on July 7th, 1936. There was a confrontation. There was a problem. Police had to come in on horseback and et cetera because people didn't want to leave their squatters. Doesn't that sound familiar, Don, that we run into that same problem? What is it? Oh, my God. 82 years later? 2 years later?
Yeah.
What, Don? The camp there in South Minneapolis. Squatters forced from home to jail. Yeah. And then the final announcement that Bassett Creek was allegedly going to be cleaned up, and this also was a announcement that preparation was being made to build the public housing. Mm-hmm. And then there are many other In fact, there was a big battle. Now, let's just do this because you have people who are on this particular board. There was a big fight with the park board, and the park board ends vote in deadlock January 8th, 1931, for those that want to get involved. And, in fact, it had to do with failure of the park board. This is interesting, too, isn't it? It just appointed the new a black man as the park board executive director. The park board fails to name successor to Horace A. Gary, and this was January 8th, 1931. In fact, they had to call police, if you will. Bassett Creek plan meets opposition. My God, Don, this was way back in April 9th, 1931. Bassett Creek project opposed, if you will, in 1931. See, there was a lot of politics going on, people trying to take control, people trying to make money, and, of course, the country, unfortunately, was moving into the beginning of the Depression, okay? And so everybody was trying to. Here's one, though, for you, Don, 1923, November 30th, 1923, Bassett Creek covering job is nearly finished. That becomes important, Don, because that's the site where workers died. They died, Don, as an outgrowth of the radon gases and et cetera, which still are emitted from that area. That's the reason there are so many people who have died and succumbed from cancer, particularly cancer of the lower extremities, if you know what I mean. So this is part of it. But let's move on. We want to get into the 1960s and folks telling us what was happening then, and we just want to kind of verify it. But go ahead, Don. You had some specific questions on that.
Yes, yes. Now that you said you're moving towards the 1960s, I guess my question is, what was the function or agency of organizations like the Minneapolis Urban League, St. Paul Urban League at the time, and the NAACP, if they were separate, if they had a Minneapolis
and
St. Paul?
Well, let's go back over there quickly. The two urban leagues in the 1930s had a staff of 1.5. NAACP's had great leadership in the form of Roy Wilkins in the 1924, 25, 26. Roy Wilkins later went on to become the executive secretary and head of the NAACP of America. Roy Wilkins, actually out of my hometown of Kansas City. Minneapolis, some say that the Minneapolis NAACP, which was headed by Bill Craddock, as I talked about, and people like Nellie Stone Johnson and them, they used to have meetings. There are documents also and pictures. They used to have meetings, both Minneapolis and St. Paul. Now, this was when there was only 1,000 Negroes in each city. They used to have meetings on Sundays, almost 200 Negroes came to meet to take care of the business of the community. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, it is, isn't it? Hmm. That was, again, in the late 1920s up into the 30s. By the way, the Negro community never had anything approaching the kind of hardships of the Depression per se, because the Negro community, under the leadership of those in that particular day, and then a newcomer by the name of Cecil Newman, who opened his newspaper, the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder, if you will, the Negro community had a plan. And businesses were flourishing on 6th Avenue North, as I said earlier, until the beginning of the demolition in 1935. There were 12 blocks of Negro community and Negro economic projects, economic existence, and et cetera, on six blocks on each side. In fact, the first time I ever had my hair cut here, was in a barbershop, which was right there almost on the corner. It was right next to the Keystone, which is a fabulous black entity, if you will. My first haircut was by your late uncle, later to be the Reverend Walter Battle. That would have been in March 1945.
Wow.
Yeah, Walter Battle had come here. I mean, I have to lay it out. Walter Battle came here, from Mississippi. Been here less than a year. And that's right. And my father took me to get a haircut. My cut up here in Indianapolis, if you will, to get white weight. And the Reverend Walter Battle. In fact, we actually became friends and et cetera over many, many years. Additional questions as we move into the 1960s, Don?
The civil rights movement, again, I go back and reference what I talked about at the beginning of the show, because I've listened to some of these live streams and some of these interviews at different places, and I'm kind of confused on the connection of who was here, you know, collaborating or speaking with people like Malcolm X and the late great Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and others in the Black Power movement or the civil rights movement through that era.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was only here a couple times. I'm not sure that Malcolm ever came here to the extent that it was a public forum, if you will. University of Minnesota was under great pressure about Malcolm X. Not so much pressure as it pertains. Now, we're talking 1960, the early 1960s, because Malcolm is killed early on. So these people that talk in terms of Malcolm, I'm not sure how they would have had any contact with Malcolm. Malcolm was dead by that time. Martin was dead by 1968, killed in April of 1968 in Memphis, Tennessee. There was some documentation that said that that really the first time that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. came to Minnesota, he was a young minister. This would have been 1957. He was a young minister of a church in Montgomery. You remember the Montgomery bus boycott, et cetera, okay?
Yes.
He came back in the early part of the 1960s, if you will. I hear people talk about that. You know, if they have pictures of them with Martin Luther King Jr. But to your specific question about the local leadership was Nellie Stone Johnson, the late Cecil Newman, if you will, Mary Kyle, the founder of the Twin City Courier, if you will. And by the way, Mary Kyle, for those such as yourself and I who are journalists and et cetera, Mary Kyle was the first and really only African-American or Negro who had her own 15-minute news broadcast live from Channel 9. She had a 15-minute
wow.
editorial reflection. This is the late and the beloved Mary Kyle. Okay. In fact, Ms. Kyle was one of the first to move onto Fourth Avenue. In fact, let me get her address here. She lived on 36th and 4th Avenue South. This would be from documentation in my possession dated January 8th, 1968. Because we also had Miss Charles Johnson of Nashville, Tennessee, who had moved here with her husband Charles Johnson, who was an engineer at Honeywell in Minneapolis, one of the few Negroes holding a position of that example and that level. Miss Charles Johnson, and known as Josie Johnson now, had come here from Nashville, had gotten a job as administrative assistant, first Negro to be administrative assistant to a white mayor here in Minneapolis. The second, by the way, was about a decade later when the late Richard Parker, who just passed from this life just a year ago, was the special chief of staff of Charles Stimby, who was a radical
member,
but he did hire and bring Richard Parker, who many Negroes were scared to death of. Richard Parker was not a punk, if you will. Big brother, 6'6", you know. Born in Mason City, Iowa, for those, again, that don't, you know.
We have a call, too. I want to let you know.
Oh, do we? Well, let's get the call. Let's get
yes.
the call. See if, yes. if, you know.
Caller, you're live on the air. Go ahead.
Happy Black History Day, Black History Month. Fellas, how are you guys today?
Yes, sir.
Celebrating.
How you doing, Brother Nelson? What can we
good,
do for
good,
you?
Good, good, good. You know, again, I love the enrichment, the values that you and the vast amount of history that you share and have been a part of, Mr. Edwards. And it's incredible to hear you always talk about things. You know, when you put things in historic fashion when speaking of 36 and 4th. I lived right on 36 and 3rd. I remember you telling me about the housing over there by, what was that, Lee's Bar over there, Mr. Edwards used to be. I think you used to live over there, if I'm not mistaken, or something, right?
When I finally got in North Minneapolis, I was living for a short period of time with my father at 44 Third Avenue South. But I used to live further up there for a while. But basically, a lot of my time was spent living in North Minneapolis. So I did live in South Minneapolis and around the area that you just talked about. You know, but go ahead, your question.
Mm-hmm. I think it's important that we keep people and keep people like yourselves in the forefront of Black history, you know, not just celebrating it during the month of February, but always relying on you and your vast knowledge of and historic perspective of what's going on. I mean, I don't know how many people know that you ran with, you know, the Nellie Stone Johnsons and all the historic people that,
they were my mentors, my brothers. See, I don't apologize.
Exactly.
I appreciate what you're saying, Brother Nelson. I don't apologize. They were my mentors. Nellie Stone Johnson, Cecil Millman, and others, Frank Alsop and Dr. Thomas Johnson, God bless them for what they provided and gave to this community. You can't even find their names in a place. But, see, I don't have a problem giving propers to people, you know what I mean?
Right.
And I think you kind of recognize that. And yes, I was very blessed. I was very blessed. And I'm blessed to still be here. You know what I mean? I was just looking if I could share this with you, because
absolutely.
I was a very, very young man then. But I was looking at the front page of the Twin City Courier dated November 15th, 1982. It was a picture of myself standing with the Reverend William Smith, the late Curtis Heron, you remember him, Reverend Maxie Turner, the late Little Herbie, Jesus Christ, and the late Gary Sutter. Now, I'm blessed, man, because I'm looking at this photo from the Twin City Courier, y'all, both of y'all. Edwards' rejection could now awaken the sleeping giant. And I'm not going to even go into that, because it was about me and my battle to be on the little Civil Rights Commission and all that other stuff and all the treachery and betrayal. But community stood behind me, and it's one of the reasons I'll always be committed to serve this community, because the community did not throw me under the bus. After 7 months of boycotts and et cetera, the Republican Central Committee, Mr. Allen sent a special negotiator here, got with Dan Cohen and former Governor Arne Carlson and them, and said, look, let that Negro on the commission and this please bring him along. 20 years later, Al Halstead wanted to reappoint me to bring me back to the commission and et cetera, and we had another battle. 20 years later. So I think that, Brother Nelson, you remember some of that. And by the way, let me just say this for the folks that are talking. This was an article in 1968, an article that said, Cohen and Carlson trade insults on rights. But most important to me was, Mr. Allen, was NAACP clergy, black clergy, back nomination of rights aid with police records. So, I mean, I'm going to be clear. I had a police record. I'm a bad Negro. I like to fight. I like to fight. You know, I had a tough partner, too. That was the late Leroy Bogart. But I say all that, gentlemen, that one of the things that I'm looking at as an example, I mean, this is all about black history. One of the people in 1980, that's when Tyrone Terrell was fired from the Civil Rights Department in Minneapolis. I'm Brother Tyrone from native Kansas City, a young man that I kind of mentored when he first came here. But one of the people that spoke out against my second tour, if you will, was a guy by the name of Bill Davis. And
Bill
I
Davis.
Think about the role that Bill Davis played.
Community action?
Democrat. Yeah. See, this is the history that is by y'all. Yeah. You have to go back to understand what happened, the history that has been suppressed, if you will. It's really sad in many regards. I even have a picture here of the guy in that Spike Boss pulling down the American flag. He was so mad that a white woman by the name of Emma Hickson was going to become the first white civil rights director. She had been brought up here from Missouri. But, there's so much
director.
In that history. Yeah, Emma Hickson was working until a couple years ago for the school district. System took care of her. Don Frazier was so angry, the great white liberal, was so angry during that particular period of time that he actually wanted to have the police actually beat us up. I'm trying to attack us and et cetera. You know, I'm aware of some real stuff to the extent that some of us had to start carrying, we had to start carrying weapons.
I think about it. I mean, I know Don and I have had many conversations about how we cherish the fact that you mentored myself, Don, and other people in this community, whether they, whether they now will speak of it or not. I'm very proud to have known and met you and respect your knowledge and of everything. And I think that people only get pissed off, Mr. Edwards, because you tell it like a T.I. is, right? And so, it is what it is. You know, they'll get over it or they won't.
Oh,
I look
sure.
at it, a
Hopefully
person like...
Not, they'll pass on to the other life and not a cop.
Exactly. Exactly. When I look at a Bill Davis, how he, if and when he hated on you, I look at him now. I mean, this is the same dude that threw his own son on the bus. So, I mean, which shows you the integrity that this guy has. So I look at him now, and then I look at you. You know, here you are still around, and look at this guy.
That's right.
You know, he robbed the community, robbed the community and didn't take care of us. And that's something that you have never done and would never do. So I mean, again, in this month, I'm with Don. Don used to always say when we had our show together. Don used to say every day is Black History Month, and so Don
is absolutely
right.
Yes, it is.
Don is right, and I want to say again, Mr. Edwards, man, I appreciate every single day that I've known you, and I appreciate the vast knowledge of historic knowledge that you know about the city, and about our people and this community. And it's most appreciated, man, especially during this month, but it's most appreciated. I hope that everyone, whenever they bump into you, take 5 or 10 minutes, because that's the type of guy you are. You are always willing to stop and listen and talk to anybody.
Yep.
So I hope that youngsters, when they bump into you, will take the time to ask you any type of historical question, because you have the knowledge of it and will give and will tell the truth about it. So
of the entire state and of the nation. Yeah, I appreciate it, brother. I appreciate it, like I said.
Thank you, Mr. Edwards.
There's a lot of documentation. Some of this I'll be showing on my worldwide link broadcast from MTN, and some of the pictures, so that the naysayers, you know what I'm saying, Brother Nelson, the naysayers don't run out there talking about their old brother and they're making something up. Now, I don't make anything up, man. It's all historical fact. Going, like I said, I started out purposely in 1913, because one of the great cover-ups, and maybe I'll do a little bit more with Don in the next number of weeks, about the great cover-up with regards to the whole issue of contamination, toxicity, and the whole tragedy of Bassett Creek, and the reason that there are so many people that lived in housing, public housing, even now, that have so many problems with cancerous-type diseases and et cetera. It's sad, but the documentation is there, my brother.
It is there. Well, all we need to do is just listen to you and lean on you, because you give us the spiritual guidance. You give us the factual knowledge of incidents, of situations, of things that have happened. So, you know, look, I always trust you and believe things that you say.
All right,
so again,
appreciate it.
I don't care about everyone getting pissed off. I appreciate you, Mr. Edwards, and Don. You guys keep up the good work, man.
All right, thank you, my brother. All right, now we're coming down to the last 5 minutes. I want to give you the opportunity to know, because you've asked a couple of questions. By the way, just so you know, as far back as 1962, the mayor of the city at that time warned that there were going to be problems in the Twin Cities, and that young Negroes, such as those that I work with, we used to have a group called PEP. I talked to you privately about it, called People Employing People. And we were a tough group of young brothers, and we were led by the late Dr. Thomas Johnson, as I said, but beloved Frank also, one of the great union organizers, longtime resident, and et cetera. That family, including his daughter and his grandson, have all passed on. But for those that lived in South Minneapolis, they knew Mr. Alston. Everybody knew Dr. Johnson and et cetera. But I want to also pay my respects to Dr. Herman Dillard, one of the great medical minds and a man who really brought the revolution home and the revolutionary concepts when he walked up and down in front of the old Lincoln High School there with a bandolero and a automatic weapon and two pistols, scared folks to death, talking in terms of education for the Negro children. You know what I'm saying, my brother? Dr. Herman Dillard. Now, his brother was, for those that pretend like they can't remember, they do remember this person because he used to scare to death, the late Bertha B. Wiley, one of the great minds. Dr. Herman Dillard, by the way, was number two in his class at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine. But he gave that up to fight the revolution, and he was murdered on the orders of the FBI in Washington D.C. at one of the protests. He was murdered. He was given a hot injection, if you will, while in his sleep. But you know, these are things that people don't want to talk about. Man, everybody gets put their heads down, or they try to pretend that they know about it, and they can't count, and they couldn't know about it. You know, 3/4 of them wasn't even around. But you've asked a couple questions as we move into the last minute. There's a whole group of folks that need to go back and retool, if you know what I mean.
You know, Mr. Edwards, on this day, February 16th, 2014, we did the exact same show, The Real History of the Twin Cities with Ronald A. Edwards.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was that date again,
same
John? What
show
was
back
that date?
In 2014. What's that?
Isn't that amazing? Yeah. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah,
that's
amazing.
Outstanding.
Incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, then. Well, like I said, you know, we, of course, Black history is anytime for us. And so we may take a look at it. If we get the right kind of contacts made with you and people ask some real specific questions. As in fact, I'm on my way to a town hall meeting at the Central Library being put on by the gentleman known as M, to talking about, get this, law enforcement and the history of law enforcement with the African-American community. I'll be there in the audience kind of listening and et cetera. One of the panelists will be Commander Charles Adams, born and raised in North Minneapolis and a guy that probably should been made a deputy chief. But, hey, Don, this is fun. This is what it's about, history. Yeah. All right.
Okay, we got about 90 seconds left. Appreciate everyone listening to the show. We'll be back next Saturday at 9:30 a.m. in the morning. Again, you're listening to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio. Mr. Edwards, any last words before we let James take us home?
James is the last word, because what James says – is what is a part of the American heritage of Black America. Thank you. Thank you. Take care, my brother.
Thank you.